This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Guy. How are you?
I'm very well. Haven't seen you for, hours.
Hours and hours. Yes, just a few hours. So it's another drummer this week.
It is another drummer, but this is not another drummer. This is an absolute mold making and breaking drummer.
Yeah, I mean a musical drummer. This guy is... You know, he sort of his percussive quality is you know, the musical sort of percussion that he's created over the years has been groundbreaking.
Yeah,
with the likes Absolutely. Of Yes, and I mean for me, he was the Yes in their pomp. You know, when he left Yes, and they did Tales from Topographic Oceans, I kind of gave up. You know, and obviously, you know, the commercial stuff came with Trevor Horn later, but those sort of first 5 Yes albums. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. That's your thing. My thing is very much the Crimson thing, and especially that spate of albums he made around 1980. I really want to talk about that.
With Tony Levin on bass.
With Tony Levin and Adrian Belew, That sort of, which was already his second stint with them.
But also, you know, Bill has been on tour with Genesis. He replaced Phil Collins, really, when Phil Collins stepped up to sing after Peter Gabriel left. And did all that a tour. He's played with Roy Harper, with Chris Squire, Patrick Mraz, and of course his own band Earthworks.
Earthworks, yeah.
God, there's
a lot. You know what? I would say he's the drumming equivalent of Jeff Beck, both in sort of technical mastery and total non-careerist follow your heart.
Would you like to tell him that? You
know, I think I would.
Well, let's get him on. Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Ah!
Hey!
Hey!
Nice to see you.
Very nice to see you. Thanks so much, Bill, for being to do this.
Absolutely. No, it's a pleasure.
Of course, because you've got a box set to sell, I guess, and that's a good excuse to get out of your retirement again.
Well, you see, the thing about retirement is that the only thing I retired from was public performance. That's the tricky bit.
Well, you say that, but you did actually play with a local soul covers band, didn't you?
Oh, how the hell did you hear that? I mean, that's so unfair. That's not even fair. You know, if we're going to go down this road.
No. It's right. We're not tabloid. We're not looking for salacious.
Yeah, I did. I played Motown for the first time in my life. And it was extraordinary.
But how was that? Because, I mean, let's face it, Bill, you're not known for just laying down a simple 4-4 all the way through a tune.
It's true. I didn't ever think I was pretty good. I didn't ever think I was any good at that. But I tell you, you'll know this, but, you know, having a whole room of people dancing is really special. It's great. You know, nobody's ever danced to anything I've ever played in my life. I don't understand why. You know, I think it's perfectly straightforward music, but a lot of other people don't dance to my stuff. So I'm thrilled to play for a room full of people dancing.
It's quite funny when you say that because I used to play with Pink Floyd, and obviously we used to play Money every night. And of course, that's the big hit. Yeah. People would go, yeah, and everyone would get up to dance. And they could, and of course, it's in 7/8, and they couldn't understand why it wasn't working.
And their usual moves weren't working. Exactly.
So what made you, you've got this box set, but what I was interested in is how you put this together, because your career is so diverse and so interesting that you, instead of putting it into bands, you've decided to put it into these four sections. The Collaborator, which obviously is Yes and King Crimson, and
then
the Composing Leader, which is your band, and Earthworks, and your, obviously your special guest work, and the Improviser, the stuff you did with Patrick Mraz.
And lots of others too. Yeah, well, it's to do with, partly to do with the way musicians operate, and you'll know about this, you know, performing with others collaboratively, such as with Yes or King Crimson, performing perhaps as a leader, performing for a leader, or perhaps without a leader at all. These are all different contexts that musicians perform in. And it's important that, that we understand which context we're performing in, I think. And it's a way of segmenting up the music, because I'm not sure the listener knows that, really. They just think we turn up and do what we want with varying levels of direction. Sometimes you're intensely directed, like when you're a special guest or something like that, or a session guy. Sometimes you're not directed at all when you're improvising. And these are quite different ways of enacting in music, I think.
Because when you did, we're probably going to be jumping around all over the place chronologically.
Yeah, but like, let's jump.
Yeah, when you did your thing with Patrick Mraz, for instance, that looked like you were very much looking for kind of, it wasn't a drummer playing with a piano player. It was very much a collaboration of equals, just two musical instruments firing off.
Indeed so, yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily one supporting the other, yeah. But then I've never been quite that sort of drummer either. I mean, we're all kind of even characters, I think, and it's more of a conversation. If you've got two people on stage, it's like a conversation, a bit like we're having now. That's what an improvisation is, really. We're making this up as we go along, folks.
Don't tell them.
Yeah, but obviously there's different levels of this. I mean, we're going to talk about these particular projects in more detail, I'm sure, but when you're working with Yes, I mean, you were a very strong collaborator, but probably the fact that there were also five other strong collaborators made that quite a difficult process at times.
It did. But musicians get better at this, figuring out how... It's all interpersonal relationships, don't you think? It's all, are you good with other people? You know, can you get along? Can you understand what the other guy's trying to say?
Play well with others.
And play well with others. You know, I mean, it's really key. It's what it's all about, isn't it? And I think some guys are better at that than others. Certainly collaborative work with four or five hot-headed guys, and you'll know this, is can be tricky. You know, of course, you've got your ideas and somebody else has got their very strong ideas. I think in sort of mid-80s King Crimson, it was really nice. I mean, we used Tony Levin on bass. I'm not going to tell Tony what to play. Yeah. You know, Adrian Belew on guitar. I don't even know how he gets the sounds out of the guitar. So. Yeah. And he's not really going to tell me what to do on the drums. You just it's assumed at that level that the guys you're working with know what's best.
You didn't mention Robert in that.
I was going to say, because on the other hand, there is none stronger probably in the business than as a leader than Robert Fripp, surely.
Well, he'd have a heart attack if you called him a leader, of course. He doesn't like being called a leader. Let's think more about thinking. It's like a conceptualist, if you like. It's like, we're going to do a bit of... I suggest, he might say, we're going to do a bit of this. We play on this particular ballpark with these particular things, and perhaps not on that particular ballpark, with things we won't do over here, things we might do here. We could try... we had lots of lovely tools we could do these things with, electronic drums and Roland guitar synthesizers and all kinds of great stuff. The words rock and jazz were never mentioned. Occasionally in the 1980s, we talk about village music and gamelans and things, which were becoming world music. It later turned into world music. Robert was a conceptualist, if you like, and would suggest things that we could do. He'd throw a number of balls in the air, if you like, and see if anybody caught them. And if they all dropped to the ground, that didn't matter either.
But is he in any way the artist who's bringing together certain mediums? You know, let's use oils, let's use pastels, let's use glass. You know, is he that guy? Or do you feel that in the room? Or once he's made his choice in musicians and everyone's equal?
everyone's equal. You can do what you want so long as he's never heard it before. There is that kind of vibe going on. Any drumming you like, Bill, so long as I've never heard it before. So he's a thinker, I think. And he's quite capable of illustrating his thoughts on the first song and a half. After that, you know, we're up and running. We're on a plan. We're on a mission. We're going to try and make that work. I'm not making any sense to you, am I?
No, you are. There's a very interesting thing I heard.
Life in King Crimson.
I think you're also being very political, but that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Because I saw your interview, because a friend of mine has just made that documentary about King Crimson, which is an absolutely fascinating film.
Toby. And Toby Ames.
Yeah. And he's my neighbour down here. And he
is he?
But the way everyone skirts around the issues is extraordinary. But there's something you said in an interview a while back, which I thought was interesting. You said you don't leave King Crimson. King Crimson leaves you.
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, it's not a career option, King Crimson. It's not a career band. It's not something you do, you know, to plan your pension on. It's not going to work that way. It's one of those bands that you're never quite sure whether it was going to be there at breakfast or not the next morning.
Yeah.
So you needed to be fairly resilient, a kind of tough guy who's, but I don't mean a tough guy, a hard guy. I mean, a guy who is not overly sensitive. I mean, I've got stuff I can do. I can do it with other people too. It doesn't have to be only King Crimson ever.
But that's because Robert's in charge of the tap that turns it on and off, I guess.
Indeed. He's got the light switch. Yeah.
Right. I mean, we could talk a little bit in detail while we're here, you know, I mean, rather than starting with your Yes stuff, because, you know, Lark's Tongues and Aspic was such an extraordinary record when it came out. I think, you know, I felt myself as a young guy buying that album, you know, that I'd stumbled into some other world that was, you know, a part education, part stimulation, part revolution against anything that was popular in my, you know, in my family, as you know, pop culture, as it were. But for you, what you seem to focus on, I think, is the introduction of a guy called Jamie Muir into your life.
Yeah, he was in King Crimson. You were never quite sure who you were going to be playing with, you know, and it might be people you've never met before or you've never even heard of before. It's possible. So you turn up at the rehearsal room and there's a guy called Jamie. I don't know what he does. How are you, Jamie? Who are you? You know, terrific. What are you going to play? He says, drums and percussion. And I say, well, that's funny because I'm going to do that too. So right off, it's going to be an interesting morning. You can tell that. So I was very arrogant, very young, 18. I still imagined 18. That the music.
18? By now you've already done Yes. No.
Oh, forgive me. Okay. Yes was at 18. I'd be 22. Yeah.
Your story was nearly something very different just then for a second.
Sorry. That's okay. That is a little young. I forgot what it's like to be 18. And so Jamie was there, and he was a bit older than me, had a bit more experience, and didn't mince words about what he thought my drumming was, which was basically a load of crap.
Wow.
So that was okay, and I recovered from that. Let's put it this way: I was still in the phase that young musicians go through, where they think that the music exists to serve them. Jamie, in no uncertain terms, pointed out that I existed to serve the music.
Oh, wow!
He was all about how music works and how you can apply yourself to music. But Robert too; these are very interesting men.
But I was thinking more about the idea of exploring musical percussion for you. Was Jamie the inspiration for that?
Yes, certainly. I was just on drum kit. I thought the world probably began and ended, you know, from my snare drum to the outer edge of my cymbals. That was kind of the world I knew. But then there are other ways of looking at percussion, and particularly in terms of timbre and the texture of the sound. So Jamie he was the first guy I heard play a trash metal drum kit, really, with a baking tray in the bass drum and chains all over the snare drum and tom-toms and bits of metal all over the place. It sounded terrific.
Wow.
But these were newer ideas to me.
And is that him at the beginning playing all the sort of on Lark's Tongue?
Yes, indeed. That's him at the beginning playing, I don't know what it is, a little thumb piano. I think he's playing thumb piano, a kalimba, you know, little tiny thumb piano.
Yeah, that's it, because it's a very, well, what you would say was to be known as village music. It's kind of very much that.
It is.
It's very ahead of its time in that respect.
It was. And what I like actually about that opening thing there, just for the first couple of minutes, it goes from the smallest instrument you could possibly think of in the world, really, a thumb piano, playing a tiny little melody, ding, 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 through to the biggest, the biggest climax at the beginning of a heavy riff that comes in about two minutes later.
And it goes
from minimal, absolutely the most minimal music you can think of to the most maximal.
It's the most extraordinary piece of music.
It's a whacking great big hit. It's great.
It really is. You know, Guy, did you see the Nick Cage movie, Mandy, recently?
No, I didn't.
Oh, well, my son, who's he's actually a very, very good musician anyway, he was obsessed with movies. Milo, he was 17. He's watching this film and he said, "Oh, Dad, have you know this track by King Crimson?" And it was, Starless is one of the tracks on that film. You must know that, Bill, do you?
I have not seen that. It's called Mandy by Nick Cage.
Nick Cage's in it, yeah. You're probably getting some royalties coming through it.
Oh, terrific. I'll stop the flow. Don't bury me in the royalties.
But that period of King Crimson, when it was just you and Robert and John Wetton, that track, by the way, starts, is one of the most beautiful. I mean, Guy sent it to me yesterday as well because he loves it too.
We were lucky with that one. We were lucky. You know, maybe with you guys too. You're not quite sure when you've recorded something. I think it takes me at least 10 years to listen to it with any dispassion at all. I have no idea whether it's any good or not when we do these things. So when we made some of the better records I've made, or well-known records like Close to the Edge by Yes, mm-hmm. or Red by King Crimson, or Larkstones by King Crimson, I tend to get up and leave the studio as quickly as I can at the end of that, and I'm not sure whether we've done any good or not.
Wow, that's quite interesting, because it's, you know, the one's meant to be excited.
I am excited, but I think I'm excited by pretty much everything I do when I've completed it. I love it. I love the whole process, but I'm exhausted. And I still can't tell whether it's got legs or not. And it's something we'll be talking about in half a century's time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, which is would be nice if that can happen. And I'm thrilled that it has happened several times for me.
Actually, to be fair with you saying that you're basically exhausted at the end of recording, you do probably work a lot harder than we've ever have done in terms of what you actually put in.
But Guy, you love that later because obviously they disbanded and they came back with Discipline.
That was that 1980 era Crimson. It was really, really special for me at the time. But why? Because it was the birth of art rock. And it felt so new and modern and relevant. And I was such a fan of Baloo and Tony's, and it was a dream lineup for me.
Yeah, but it was great, great fun.
But what's interesting is because there's something in Tony's playing, which I think brings a certain humour to things. I think, which in a way that a lot of bass players can't. I don't know how to describe that.
A certain humour.
Yeah,
I think he's got. Well, he's got lots of things he's good about. First of all, he doesn't say anything, and secondly, he plays exactly the right thing, which is always too great. Great things. But also, he gives you this feeling, doesn't he, that he's making it up for the first time as he plays the bass that night. Now, he may have well played the same notes in the same order a couple of nights earlier, but it doesn't feel like that. It feels like every time he's inventing it again new for you. And I think it's very important in repetitive part playing. You have the feeling that it's new. Tonight, it's new and it's for you. It's really important.
It's like the myth. I always think of hotel rooms. It's why you can never be comfortable in a hotel room if you go in and it hasn't been made up. Because the myth is good. Because all this myth is you go into this hotel room and no one's been there. It's your room.
I never thought of that. put me off hotels completely now.
That's something you have to do with gigs. It's the same thing that to the audience, this is the only gig you're playing.
Correct. Yeah. I think it's a very good way to look at it. And I fidgeted too much. I think I was bad at repetitive music. I used to get fed up with playing the same thing twice, much to the irritation of my colleagues. I think I should probably have adopted some of these much more mature attitudes that we're looking at it now, and that I probably would have enjoyed the music more on a nightly basis than I actually did at the time.
Are you saying that possibly one of the reasons you're so adventurous and textural in your playing and diverse is because it would be bloody boring just to lay down a backbeat throughout a whole song?
I think that's a very succinct way of putting it. Yeah, I'm not really your backbeat guy. it's nothing wrong with backbeats, and people do it really well. And I have nothing but respect for anybody, any way anybody wants to get on in music. However, my way happens to be finding something a bit different, or trying to imagine how drums could be used differently, or how could we place the beat in a different way, or what would make this, what would keep this drummer awake, and what would keep the audience awake.
Yeah.
You know, the trouble with a backbeat is that the listener tends to start at the beginning and check that the rhythm is happening psychologically and it goes okay. And then nobody listens to the drummer again for the next 7 minutes unless something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Which is okay, but I feel more outward going than that.
Do you know, I got a bass player and a drummer right here in front of me. This is great, right? So we were talking about Tony Levin here and this very distinct sound that he has and the strong personality. I'm just wondering, are you playing differently if it's a different drummer? Or Bill, are you playing differently if it's a different bass player? Or is this little tug of control that is constantly going on?
Good question. Guy, you first.
Okay, well, there's multiple different relationships between bass players and drummers. There are drummers I work with where I feel really, really tight. And it's like Jed Lynch, for instance, who I work with a lot. It's like my notes will always fall on his bass drum. It's just that's what happens. Then there's someone like Andy Newmark where our groove is always completely locked in. He's not really, feels like he's not really listening to me. The bass drums don't sync up, but the whole thing works beautifully. And then there's other people you tell what to do. Now your turn.
That doesn't include Nick Mason. Nick Mason.
No, Nick, I absolutely don't. But Nick is so fantastically musical and snaky.
Really good. It's a very good answer. I just think I'm playing with people rather than instrumentalists. I'm not sure I'm particularly more tuned into the bass player than the fiddle player. It's just that the bass player probably will be playing throughout the song, mostly. In much popular music. However, in King Crimson, it was all episodic music. People would come and go. The drums might start and stop seven times in a seven-minute piece of music. And sometimes the continuum or the most running, the most space occupied by an instrument might be the guitar player. So I'm listening more to the guitar player. The bass player stopped by that point. You see what I mean? I don't have that fixed relationship. I never did have a fixed relationship with the bass player in quite that sense.
Even with Chris Squire?
Even with Chris Squire, I would say. I mean, he was three quarters of the way up the bass neck anyways. Yeah. Sounding a little like a lead guitar. So,
yeah. A little?
I don't know. I've never rationalized this thing about drummers and bass players. We play together. It seems okay to me, kind of thing. It's about as far as I get.
But you had, because you had one period in Crimson where you were essentially two trios. Which bass player am I playing with?
Wow, yeah, very true. How to mix, this is a great one for producers, how to mix an album with two drummers, two basses and two guitars. You know, that's tricky. Where do you put the bass drum, the one that's playing? Do you put that in the middle or do you both kits left and right, except that the left guy's not playing at that time, for example? So that was quite interesting. But they were bass players nominally, but everybody was contributing to a fabric of music, yes. And I joined in that too, and I didn't prioritize one musician over another. I don't just lock in with a bass player, for example, and listen to nobody else, which is what some drummers might do.
Well, you can never not listen to Robert, surely.
This is true. It would be unwise.
Should we go back to your beginnings, Bill, in music?
And, of course.
What first turned you on?
Well, it's very simple, really. I came from jazz, which is a four-letter word. A bit like rock. I was listening to, I think you with Nick Mason or somebody like that. I can't remember, but somebody was saying that rock was the new old people's home, which is a fantastic phrase. Yeah. I mean, both the words rock and jazz are so tired that they should be retired. Yeah. You know. However, I started as what was called a jazz musician in the sort of 50s and 60s and grew up with jazz, learned how to play jazz drums.
What turned you on? Why not the Beatles like everyone else?
Oh, well, mostly you can blame the BBC. You know, it was BBC Jazz 625 on Saturday nights, prime time. Humphrey Littleton was the MC, and they had in all the great guys. They had in, you know, Freddie Hubbard and Art Blakey and Max Roach and Sonny Stitt and, you know, all the great guys. So I just sat there as a 12-year-old with a pair of drumsticks, bewitched. And right away, well, two things immediately. I couldn't understand how nobody seemed to play any wrong notes. How was that possible? That nobody, there's no music and nobody played any wrong notes. That was brilliant. And the second thing was that the drummer at the back seemed to have a huge amount of control, that nobody really went anywhere very far without the drummer's say-so. So he was like kind of a guy driving a coach and horses at the, you know, up on the thing, the four horses and the drummers at the back on a riser. And when he whips the whip, they can really go. When he just reins it back in, they rein back in. There's a great sense of ebb and flow generated from Art Blakey.
Well, he's the leader of the band.
That's true. But I started with jazz. But the great thing I did, of course, which you guys nearly did, but not quite as well as I did, was get born in 1949.
Yeah, top work
which
there.
Which puts you at kind of 18 or 19 years old in 1968. Ooh. Kind of magical age, you know, where everything was happening, you know, Paris riots and Jimi Hendrix and God knows what. It was all, you couldn't really go wrong because it was such an exciting time, I think.
Yeah.
And all the jazz guys were slipping into this new thing called rock, you know. So Mitch Mitchell, who I knew in the Riot Squad and as a studio musician, he was falling into Jimi Hendrix and kind of playing Elvin Jones in Jimi Hendrix, you know.
And then Bitches Brew coming up.
A few years ahead. But it was a very exciting time. You could be anything you wanted to be, except, funnily enough, you could be Coltrane or you could be Jimi Hendrix, but you couldn't quite be both. You're not allowed to like both. You know, jazz was jazz, and they were terrible at playing rock. And rock was rock, and they were even worse at playing jazz. And never the twain shall meet, you know. And you were, as a rock guy, you were seen to be, as a jazz guy, you were selling out if you joined a rock guy. Terrible. Remember selling out?
Yeah, but that's interesting you say that. Yeah. Because someone like Peter Banks, you know, the original guitar player from Yes,
yeah,
and you know, and in Mabel Greer's Toy Shop,
yeah,
you know, you listen to his solos, and yes, you can hear the future of progressive music. You can hear Steve Howe, you can hear Steve Hackett, but you can also hear jazz. There's a jazz style in there. Is progressive music the answer to this combination of, you know, of not being able to do one or the other?
That's an interesting idea. As if by default, if you can't do one or the other properly, you end up as a progressive rock musician.
But you wish to do
both. That's quite a good idea.
I would say there was sort of two branches with that, wasn't there? In the progress, the people who wanted to be jazzier became what became fusion. And a lot of the progressive stuff, I would say, was rock musicians who actually had classical chops and wanted to play. There was a lot of classical stuff in there.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. There's very little jazz in progressive rock. I mean, if you take somebody like Rick Wakeman, I mean, there's not a note of jazz in a man's body. I mean, he doesn't know what a blue note or a bent note is. It's not possible. He arpeggiates everything. He's a college guy, and he's quintessentially progressive. If anybody was the jazz guy, I was the jazz guy, I guess, because I wanted to make it up as I went along, and I kept leaving groups and joining other ones.
I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that it sort of came out of psychedelia in a way, didn't it? I mean, there were, you know, Syd Barrett and Floyd, and
yes,
and I love this the name of this band that you were once in, a psychedelic band called Paper Blitz Tissue.
Either you've got a brilliant researcher, or you've been digging like crazy, or you've done your homework or something. I've tried to keep that quiet for about half a century, and now you've ruined my cred.
It sounds so cool. I mean, it seems it's the club that his scene revolved around.
But it also sounds like one of those art cards that Eno hands out. You know, play this in the style of Paper Blitz Tissue.
It sounds like strategy. All of those. Yeah. All of those things, you know. I mean, in my defense, you know, I only lasted three nights. So these are pickup gigs that you get when you don't know anything or anyone.
There's nothing to defend. Being in Paper Blitz Tissue is probably the highlight of your career.
No, no, but I think what I'm saying is psychedelia was definitely an introductory drug into progressive music.
It certainly was. It certainly was. It preempted, you know, there was the British blues boom around the same time. and some of the blues groups strapped on a bit of psychedelia. Now, funny enough, we were talking, weren't we, a few seconds ago about Nick Mason. And one of my first gigs, which I remember very well, was at the Piper Club in Rome with a band you've also not heard of, thank heavens, called The Noise. And The Noise supported the Pink Floyd in the Piper Club in Rome for a few nights. And, you know, I love the Floyd now, of course, but then I didn't think any of us thought they were up to much, you know.
Yeah.
And they just seemed like a bluesy group with some sort of liquid light show thingy, which wasn't very effective.
Well, it's quite funny you mentioned as a jazz guy, because Nick has always said that because their template in their psychedelic days, which for songs like Interstellar Overdrive, which we do, which is that you was the jazz template. You had a riff which you played at the start, then you went off into a freeform section, then you came back to the riff and you ended it. And so the difference being that jazz players do that as you have an extended break to show off just how great musicians they are. Whereas Pink Floyd were using it as the complete opposite to show how they were just completely winging it.
Well, I'm not all sure that all jazz musicians are showing off what great musicians they are. But it's a good distinction, yeah.
So let's talk about that. This suddenly you meet John Anderson, do you?
Yeah.
How did that... Tell us about that meeting.
Well, you're too young to know this, but there was a thing called the Melody Maker.
Melody Maker was big enough.
We all joined bands through Melody Maker. Come on.
Well, so we joined a band. So I'd advertised or he'd advertised. I can't remember. And I said, you know, I could probably... I went along and met them at the Shass in Wardour Street, which is a drinking club of the day. And
too young for that.
We said... I was Chris and John, Chris Squire and John Anderson. And we'd propped up the bar and probably had a pint. And they said they had a gig that night at Rachel McMillan's College in Deptford. And they were a bit stuck for a drummer. And how would I come along and have a play? And I did. And so my audition was a gig, I think. All I can remember about it was playing In the Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett for about an hour. It was the only song we knew. But they could sing really well. I remember also being hugely impressed by vocal harmony, and they could sing. It was great. So,
because you were essentially a covers band at first, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure many other rock groups of the day were as well. Yeah, we took stuff by strange bands like, Fifth Dimension.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And Vanilla Fudge and the Beatles and... We started tinkering with them and making them a bit longer and a bit more long-winded and playing the bit we liked twice because we liked it. So we'd play it twice and so on and so forth until eventually we substituted our own bits of music for the bits of music we were spoiling and ruining. And slowly we found our own template for how to make things work.
So there hadn't been a vision of any of that when you got together to like, we're going to write our own stuff, we're going to... there was no plan.
Yes, it were pretty early on. Yeah, John Anderson was very quick to jump on writing his own songs, but somehow we thought the thing written by a bloke called Leonard Bernstein was probably going to be better.
Yeah, you did America, didn't you?
Yeah, we did America. Pretty soon, I mean, over a couple of years or so, you know, we got better at writing our own stuff, for sure. But, in those days, you could have two or three albums. Before the record company said, hold on.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't sold a record to anybody. We're letting you go, you know, which we were terrified of.
Yeah, because of the first two albums, Yes and Time and a Word, there was a feeling of, I even listening back now, that you're not quite sure what kind of a band you wanted to become.
Completely. I think Atlantic Records in New York thought that we were a British folk group for the first album or two. They knew very little about us and had no idea how to promote it at all. But we got better at the third album.
No, I mean, yours is no disgrace. I mean,
that was fun.
Incredible.
Getting much closer, yeah.
But what's interesting, Bill, is that you say we weren't quite certain of what sort of band we wanted to become. But looking back, what's so funny is that it was this absolutely magical period where all of the bands were becoming bands that no one had ever been before. So it's all, you know,
that's true.
So you couldn't really know what you were going to become because it had never existed.
That's perfectly true. And I'm very comfortable with a bit of a mystery. I don't mind at all not knowing what's going on. It seems to me an essential part of being an artistic or creative guy is there will be times when you don't know what it is that you're doing, and that's perfectly okay. No need to judge the outcome necessarily either. Mm. In fact, if I'm ever asked to instruct young musicians, which is unwise, but sometimes I do, I recommend that at least twice or preferably three times a year, they are in some musical setting or another in which, for sure, they absolutely know they do not know what to play here.
Yeah.
I think that focuses the attention no end. You find out what kind of a drummer you are pretty fast if you sit down with Robert Fripp and Jamie Muir and they say play.
That seems to be happening on stage with us a lot at the moment, but I think it's more to do with age than anything else. What am I meant to be doing here?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This was revolutionary music. This was more dangerous than anything that had come before. Not only was it I say dangerous because it wasn't guaranteed any kind of radio slots. Yeah. It wasn't going to, you know, get you on Top of the Pops or boost your bank balance. But you were all willing to take this risk to make something that was musically, architecturally grand and huge and challenging.
Yes, that's true. But you make it sound as though we were a brave lot and far too brave. And you're describing it without the context. Bear in mind, the context was fabulous. There were 24-track recording studios emerging everywhere. There was a thing called the FM radio network in the United States. There was stereo positioning. Capitol Records made so much money with the Beatles, it didn't know what to do with it. You could be anything you like post-Beatles. If they had a sitar player, you could have a sitar player. If they had an orchestra, you could have an orchestra. Nobody was watching the clock in the recording studio. I mean, this was easy. Everybody had a gig. You could play anything you wanted to.
Yeah, but also, because that was the thing for us as kids. It was, we were used to just constantly hearing music that sounded like nothing we'd ever heard before. That was kind of you're only really interested in something if it sounded like something you'd never heard before. No.
That's lovely, isn't it? I think that's great. I mean, it makes for fascinating listening and fascinating being a musician too. If people are saying, play something I've never heard before, or let's do it this way, or let's play it backwards, or the Pink Floyd do it this way, let's do it another way.
But also, it's interesting what you said about about FM radio in America, which shows you how all the, because so many of these bands came from England, but you were clearly having to tailor your stuff for America because that's the only place it was going to, I mean, it wasn't going to get on Radio 1.
Correct. I remember going up and down England so often in a couple of years. I think we played Birmingham Town Hall about 5 times in 6 months, something like that. And really realizing how small the UK was and how we weren't going to get any further. We just had to get to America. And it was quite a long time in coming. We were 3 years into a career before we finally managed to get on a Jethro Tull tour, which was fabulous and a huge sense of relief and a sense that here was a big place and they could play close to the edge on a radio, and they would, and they did, which is amazing.
And this is amazing because there's nothing American about this kind of music, is there? There doesn't feel very much. It's mostly classical and folk and all the things that come from the heart of Europe.
Totally. Totally. There's very little rhythm and blues in there, very little black music in there.
Yeah. But I suppose, for Americans, this was, you were going into, this was like the new Wild West, but it was somewhere else. It was, you were opening maps of music that you taking you by surprise at every turn. And I think that's what made the grand pieces of 18-minute long songs so exciting. But how did you work that all out in a rehearsal writing process?
It was fairly tortuous. There was a lot of blood on the floor. It was ugly.
Who brings it in? Who starts the process?
Well, usually John Anderson would start it by playing something so inadmissible, something so horrible on the guitar that by default, Steve Howe would have to say, John, we can't do that. It's awful. But we could do this. You know, and it was all provocative like that, really. And bear in mind, we were stitching the albums together 16 bars at a time. You know, we'd stop and tape edit. Stop, another 16 bars. Oh, that sounds good. Where could we go from here? Rick? And Rick, being a great musician, would say, oh, it's easy. You just modulate and play it backwards with an aleatoric what's it. And we'd go, great idea. Let's do that. And on a good day, and by the way, halfway through this process, we'd break down the drums, break down the little kit and go and play a gig in Newcastle and come back and set it all up again and pick it up at letter F, you know, 48 bars into the song.
And so it's never going to sound quite the same, is it?
No, yeah. Never sounds quite the same.
And are you working in these suites, these ideas of, oh, this is this part one of the song, part two of the song?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got an introduction, but and we've got a kind of bridge to something, but it's got to be joined by a verse, and then we're going to need a codicil and a second subject maybe even, and all sorts of things would come and go. And, of course, you weren't recording these rehearsals, and I wish we had recorded the rehearsals, because then we'd all remember what somebody had agreed last Tuesday was the best thing. Because you'd say, let's do it like we did last Tuesday. And somebody would say, I don't remember what we did last Tuesday.
But recording was awkward then. It's not like now where everyone's got everything on their phone anyway. It was a pain in the ass to be recording everything, right?
It was very complicated, very hard. And, of course, the drummer had to get it right. They couldn't really start the whole overdubbing process, which took months, until the drummer had said, okay, that's it. So the drummer was forever dropping in on edits. You know, where there's cymbals flying all over the place and the tempos are changing and the pitch of the snare drum has dropped because you've changed the drum head from and all that stuff. It was messy.
But were there many overdubs or are you all in the room at the same time?
We're all in the studio. Everybody's playing at once, but on the assumption that 4 out of 5 people will replace their parts. They didn't all do that. But mostly parts were we played on top of the drummer. And if you look at the 16 track going round, the 24 track, every time I pop my fingers, that's an edit.
Right.
Across the whole album, you know, with all the music. So we had a lot of sharp knives. Very dangerous in a recording studio. A lot of very sharp.
I remember those
sharp
those
razor blades.
So tense moments editing the 2-inch.
Yeah, very tense.
You put Heart of the Sunrise on the box set.
Yeah.
It's one of the most... I was re-listening to it yesterday. The complexity of your parts, and yet the adventurousness, but at the same time, the excitement that it contains,
yeah,
is so extraordinary. Yeah. I think it's one of those... If you've got to show anyone a piece of prog music, and you're particularly about you, that seems to me, Heart of the Sunrise is the one.
I think so too, and it was really the template for the next couple of albums that came. So Close to the Edge is something similar. So by now you're getting used to the idea of this, you know, heroic masculine introduction, you know, of great complexity and vigor, giving away to some smoky, more pastoral kind of feminine sort of rather phase song. And then there'd be a slower version of that played, and then a backward bit, and then a, you know, you were getting used to a sort of format, a template, if you like,
going to
for that style of music.
To the major keys at the end and the triumph and the
yes,
anthemic stuff.
Triumphant anthemic stuff, absolutely. Got to have it.
Also, one point about that is your sound on that, your drum sound is so hi-fi and modern for the time. It's, I don't know, it strikes me as it could have been recorded 10 years later.
Oh, it's interesting. I never thought about it. I didn't really think of a thing called a drum sound. Yeah. I didn't quite know what that was. It was what I thought you heard back off the recording tape. I set my drums up and I played them, and that was that, really. Nobody said anything much. So it was all very, very simple.
Well, it's Eddie Offord was the producer. Eddie Offord.
Indeed. Eddie Offord was the recording engineer. And he didn't say much. I mean, he was great at editing. and of course, mixing was always a fairly ugly scene with with about six pairs of hands. That's
on your knees. Everyone on their knees, three faders.
Yeah. Right. Drop in the cymbals now. Too late. You know.
But you were mixing in sections as well, I take it.
Mixing in sections a little, but it's no automated mixing.
Yeah.
So you couldn't.
You couldn't keep them. Yeah, you have to.
You can't keep a section. You've got to go all the way through.
So then you basically
have 18-minute song,
and then edit down the mixes once you get to the half inch.
Yeah.
Can we talk about Close to the Edge? Because that was my introduction to Yes, really, and the phenomenal three tracks. That's all it contains. The mighty Close to the Edge, but also. And You and I, and Siberian, I used to call it Katru in those days, but it's probably Katru. Or...
Well, I don't know. Take your pick. I'm not sure either.
But You and I is, I mean, we'll talk about it because obviously it was also the album that you found very difficult to make. But you actually wrote Eclipse, which is a section of And You and I.
They were very good at being very generous to the drummers.
But that's not a drumming part.
Embryonic kind of. Compositional things and bits and pieces. I wrote some of that, that's for sure.
But what was it like making this record? Because you've said that it was a little bit of a struggle.
I'm afraid so, and I don't apologize for that at all. You know, it's never, I don't think it's going to be particularly easy. We talked earlier about collaborative work with four or five strong-headed individuals. We were self-aware, self-conscious, and it was taking a long time. And I probably didn't behave very well, I shouldn't think. I was probably irritating and irritated. But we got there in the end. That's the main thing.
But is it because you all worked at different speeds? Some people were more forensic than others?
Yes. I think absolutely that's true. And, of course, the drummer has to sit and wait a lot of the time. Mm. Until everybody's ready to you know, there'd be a committee decision on should the bass note be an F sharp or an F natural at that point. And that's one note out of many that are going to come, you know.
And of course, John and Steve get the credit for the writing on the majority of the stuff. Was it really their call on all of it?
Yes, I think the writing credits are fair. You know, I would say the writing credits are fair. Mostly they did most of the work, but, you know, don't underestimate the input of the other guys. You know, Rick was a great technician in that he could turn a pig's ear into a sow's ear into a silk purse.
Because you're about to embark on the tour of Close to the Edge. And I think you get up to the... did you actually start rehearsals with the band?
No. We'd finished the album and I thought it was time to change to King Crimson, which I really wanted to do. And bear in mind,
that's a hell of an option to have for anyone to have. Yes, King Crimson.
I was very, very young, and I'd really only seen, you know, four or five bottoms in front of me, if you see what I mean. Because drummers only see people's rear ends, and I'd only ever seen, you know, four or five guys. We played with four or five guys, so I was desperate to hear myself in some other context. Because for me, music's, you know, quite largely learning about yourself and trying to figure out what it is that you want to do and how you shape meaning in music for yourself. And you do that by playing with other guys, I think. And I had only played with so few, so I'd done my bit, put it like that.
I am, Gary and I were talking about this earlier, because I find you comparable to Jeff Beck in that way. A, the technical mastery, but B, the thing of just being your own man, of just.
There's something in that. I never thought about that. And it's a hopelessly flattering comparison, but to Jeff, no, just kidding.
Well, no, but I mean, you've never done anything careerist in any way, have you? You're absolutely true to your muse.
That's true, and I strongly recommend if you can. All young musicians listening, making a shed load of money if you can by the age of 22. The reason being that you can then play what the hell you like after that. And there's no man on earth who's going to say you've got to do this because you've got to do it, otherwise you're dead in the water. Yeah.
But I was also saying to Guy that I felt when you left, you know, the band never really, until Trevor Horn came along, it never really... got close to the quality of those albums, the first five albums that you played on, or certainly the last three albums that you played on. Was there a sense from the others that was because of your leaving?
Well, two things you should know right away. I never heard the next record, Tales from a Topographic Ocean, or the Topographic Oceans. I didn't hear that record.
I still
have never heard it, funnily enough.
Wow.
And it's not that I'm being bloody-minded or something. It's just I lost interest in that particular... I wanted to turn my back on that particular field of endeavour, the Yes world, and extricate myself from it. And I wouldn't do that if I kept listening to records and finding out what people thought of them and, you know, staying in that whole world. I'd moved camp. And although people tend to think, particularly our American friends, tend to think all British progressive rock groups are the same, I can assure you the difference between Genesis, King Crimson and Yes are as gulfs in between all three, the way these things work. So I just wanted to move. So I didn't follow Yes at all until I heard Owner of a Lonely Heart on the radio. And I thought, wow, that sounds cracking.
Yeah.
I didn't know, you know, complete stripped down non-progressive style. I thought, that sounds great.
Well, it's got, but then it's Trevor Horn. It's Trevor Horn record, you know, that's.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you did come back, didn't you, later on in the 80s with Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe.
ABWH, which sounds like, an offence. Sounds like something you get done for.
GBH.
ABWH, Gov.
Yeah, let's put him in 20 years.
So you came back, but why wasn't it called Yes? Because it basically was Yes.
All kinds of legal reasons.
Right.
And there was a British Yes and an American Yes. And don't even go there. It's too boring for words.
And there was a French oui and a Spanish C as well, wasn't there?
I'm sure there were, yeah.
You spoke about drumming with different bands before, and you know, you're very much a man who creates parts. What was it like joining Genesis and feeling that you had to actually copy Phil?
Well, they were quite particular. Yes, and I remember Mike Rutherford kind of saying, well, it should really be this symbol at that point and that symbol at that point. And I'm not very good at that. I'm not very good as a... You don't want me on a studio record, really. Or I was doing a studio, as it were, session musician thing, being paid to play. And that's okay, but I had no emotional connection to the music. I mean, don't laugh, I'm a drummer. I know you're going to find this funny. But I need some kind of emotional input into the
thing. It's as true of a drummer as any other musician, absolutely.
You know, with Yes and Crimson, I was owning my parts, owning the music. It was whatever you heard was me, which is lovely. And in Genesis, which is probably not a wise choice for me to go and play with, they were charming. They're absolutely lovely guys. And I felt I was probably too irritating and kind of... They listened to what I said, which was very stupid.
Yeah, but Guy, you agree with me. His name came with a lot of weight back in those days. And when you hear, Bill Bruford is filling in for Phil Collins on the Trick of the Tail.
You kind of go, oh, of course. Of course. Yeah.
I
think it would have sold tickets as well.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, you're kind. Phil's a lovely guy. We got on great as drummers. I mean, you know, he's a terrific drummer. And we got on fine in that department.
Because didn't you do some Brand X stuff? Didn't you do some?
A little bit with Phil. That's where we were knocking around together. And he said, well, Peter Gabriel's leaving. And I'm auditioning all these guys and they're all terrible. And I reckon I sing better than most of these other people. So obviously, you know, there was a moment's silence. And either one of us or the other said, well, why don't you sing and I'll play the drums until you're comfortable.
Wow.
Because he knew my stuff and I knew his stuff, sort of thing, enough to fake it.
So were you doing? Was he just out front all the time for that at all?
No, not at all. There were two or three long instrumental
bits
where he'd come back, and there was a great ending section called Los Endos.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which was a sort of two drum thing, and it was great. It was a good show, and they were very kind to me, very kind, and I feel I could have been more grateful. Sorry, guys.
We'll pass it on. We'll tell Mike.
But We should talk about some of your, as you call it, special guest in the box set. Now we're on to you playing with other bands, but you were talking to me about the Roy Harper album yesterday, weren't you, guys?
Yeah, I loved it. That. HQ, fabulous.
Yeah, it was good. Nice record, wasn't
really
it?
Really nice record.
Lovely. Thank you. And although it's nothing to do with me, it's all his songs and everything.
But that's very straightforward for you, isn't it?
It's very straightforward and a sort of quiet day at the office. Mm-mm. I didn't have to think too much because probably my first or second idea would do. Whereas with King Crimson, until you've got to idea number 15,
yeah,
you know, until you've worked yourself into a stew trying to find something more interesting. So the album was lovely because Roy is such a lovely guy, but he does have a fairly destructive, there's a little destructive side to him, I think.
Yeah, it's a shame that you didn't play on the game, that the first big track, because that's with David Gilmour and John Paul Jones.
Yeah, well,
I think that's the only one now, that you're not on.
Is there a drummer on that?
Yeah.
Who the hell's the drummer?
I looked it up yesterday. I can't remember.
I've forgotten the name of the album, by the way.
HQ.
It's HQ.
It's called HQ. I can't remember.
It's got that beautiful song on there when an old cricketer leaves the crease.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
On this, obviously, as a drummer, you're serving the song, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I quite understand the rules of the game.
And that's a different process to King Crimson.
It is. And really, the few bits of sessioning I did, I learned very fast.
But that must leave so much empty space in your head that's usually taken up with what you're playing.
I'm not sure it's that.
I might not have put that very well.
I'm not quite sure what it is. It's a vague feeling that I'm, what is it? That I'm sort of not in the right place. That somebody else would probably be doing this better than me. Steve Gadd, for a start, would do it better than me. And he'd do it in half the time. And good session musicians are terrific. But I just wasn't one of those guys. I'm better in a less controlled circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in the studio, as you guys know, it's controlled, highly controlled. And you've got to remember everything and do everything exactly right. And I'm better in a messier circumstance where nobody knows what right or wrong is.
Right.
And then I'm more comfortable.
Right.
Such as in improvising, for example.
Because there was one band lineup you had, wasn't it, where essentially, and I can't remember the name of it, I'm really sorry, this is terrible researching on my part, but where you had basically, where you were playing what was sort of became all the, most of the polyphonic melodic instruments. And then you had three single lineups. You had a bass, a sax, and an E-flat horn or something.
That's correct. Yeah,
that was that Earthworks?
That was one formation of Earthworks, or was that wasn't?
It was. Yeah. It was kind of beginning of Earthworks, where the electronic drum set had come of age, and instead of just being something a bit lumpen and a bit stiff as it was in the early 80s, it was getting better, and it got better over about 10 years, really, from sort of mid 80s to mid 90s. And somewhere around that time, it became MIDI capable, and you could start to play chords and controllable under velocity. So the harder you hit it, the more notes in the chord you got, and so forth, which could become quite expressive. And I thought I'd form a so-called jazz group in the sense that there wasn't any vocals, with some young British guys, and I'd play most of the melodic and harmonic information, and the other guys would play well. I played the harmonic and rhythmic information. The other guys had played the melodic. They only had single line instruments, saxophone, E-flat tenor horn, and bass.
Of course. No keyboards.
Well, keyboards came into it as well later on. But part of this thing about finding a template for your group is you don't have to do it necessarily. Right. You know, it starts you off. It gets you going. If you can't complete it, it doesn't have to become a rigid straitjacket.
Do you think that was a lesson you'd learned from Robert?
Totally. You get people going on a path which they can then imagine how the music can work, and then you can kind of stand back. And if they're good players, like the guys I've always been fortunate enough to play with, I mean, Demon, then they'll pick up the ball and run with it, you know. And these guys did. Django Bates and Ian Ballamy, they were kids, they're 21, 22. Yeah. They'd never heard of Genesis or Yes or King Crimson. Interesting.
I've just remembered something. I worked with Pat Masalotto a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I did a funny little tour of Sweden with him. Amazing player. But he was talking about something that you'd said to him about how it's hard to get sessions. There was a phrase you came up with. He said, once you've defined yourself as a rhythm terrorist, you won't get any straight sessions anymore.
I think there's some truth in that. You know, if you're seen as a disruptor or you're,
I think
you're
meant,
good in that,
I think it meant more just musical. Well, he thought you meant more in musical style, the playing as a rhythm terrorist rather than a drummer.
Yeah. I think something in that. It's good. Your days as an in demand studio musician would be numbered if you go around saying that stuff.
But that begs the question, really, is what do you think people want when they want Bill Bruford to come and play drums for them?
That's a good question. A great question. Well, it's been 20 years since that happened. Yeah. So the world has changed a lot. But if you take Aldo Meola, for example, sort of American guitar star, or Kasumi Watanabe, Japanese equivalent, people like David Torn, they're looking for a slice of Bill Bruford, certainly, the sort of things that they'd heard in King Crimson. So the stuff, the so-called King Crimson rhythm section of Bruford and Levin had got some brownie points, gathered some brownie points in the 80s, which we expended like crazy through into the 90s and 95, till at the end, I think everybody was sick of us.
We all want to know why you retired.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. And
at 59, you retired, didn't you?
Oh, 60, come on.
60, then.
Because I couldn't really hear in my ears what came next. By that, I don't mean what came next at bar five after bar four. I could remember that, of course. I couldn't imagine what more I could do to contribute.
Wow. But this fits into your narrative very well of being your own man and controlling, you know, the controlling when you stop.
Okay. True, it does. And I'm all for quitting while you're ahead. I think that's good. I like, you know, every drum stool I'm sitting on, it is a drum stool that some other guy, a younger person, could be on. So I'm not a great fan of elderly rock, really. And I'm feeling that some of we older guys should shift over a bit to let younger guys have the stage, certainly in terms of drummers. I am of that feeling, and I thought I'd sort of clear myself away and go and do something else.
Well, luckily, the old drummer we're working with is the only guy who does what he does, and so there's no one else who should do it, so we're fine doing what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
No regrets, though, Bill. No urge to pick. I mean, people must be phoning you all the time and saying, come on, come and play in the studio for me.
Well, you're very kind, but there are younger drummers, terrific younger drummers. And
or worse than that, there are plenty of records with no drummers on that sound like that electronically
That's
played.
That's true. There's automated drums everywhere, which is totally convincing. I think there's a whole army of young people who've never heard a human being playing with another human being on a record, ever.
Do you regret, are you saddened by the fact that extremely brilliant musicianship is no longer necessarily commercial? I mean, if you when thinking back to your days of Yes, you know, this is the most extraordinary players coming up with the most extraordinary difficult things and getting the albums to number one. That sort of doesn't exist, does it?
It doesn't really, but it rather depends what you're calling extreme. You know, I think you're referring to extreme instrumental prowess.
Yes.
But, you know, like Paderewski on the violin or, you know, I mean, guys who can really play. That's an old 18th century idea, 19th century idea as well. And I think there's a modern version of that. Do you know Lewis Cole?
No. I should do.
You should definitely know Lewis Cole. These are the guys.
We could have just said yes and then go and research it. So by the time this comes out,
it's going to be everyone over Twitter now going, "What an idiot!" Yeah.
Lewis Cole.
Did he win the X Factor?
I mean, young guys conceptualize a whole thing about all their music because they can play all the instruments. You know, Jacob Collier.
Yes.
Yes. Of course.
Yeah. Well, young people can. conceptualize everything about the music. They play the drums, they play the bass, they can arrange the heck out of it for the WDR big band. They can have a choir sing it, or So I think that is virtuosity, being able to marshal vast amounts of music from all corners of the earth, get it into a coherent form, either with humans or without humans, and produce some sort of a product at the end of the day which says, this is me. I think that's hugely virtuosic. Now, the guy might not be Bill Bruford as a drummer, or he might not be, you know, I don't know, Eric Clapton on guitar, but it doesn't matter. He's got a broader over understanding where this music is going, and I think that's terrific. So I think there's a kind of virtuosity going on in music, although it's not necessarily instrumental.
Bill, thank you so much for coming on. We've been wanting to get you on for a while. Is one of our elements in this series of
it wasn't
podcasts.
Meant to be, but it's just how it seems to be where we've come. Before we do go, I wonder, because one of the first things I did, I got in touch with my old friend, well, both of our friend, Phil Manzanera, about your coming.
Yes,
apparently
yes.
He's been a champion of this show for early on, and he was saying you've got to get Bill on, and I think he was actually reaching out. But I said, have you got anything you'd like to say for us? And he said, apart from wondering why he still looks so young, total admiration for pursuing his own musical dream, being his own man, and if something doesn't feel right, he's off. Very industrious, very witty and self-deprecating. But this is the key thing that I was referring to. It's very difficult for a drummer to have a unique style, but I can spot Bill's drumming a mile off just by the sound of his snare.
There's something in that, I suppose. The way you hit a drum counts. Mm. But I'll tell you another thing that is actually important about that, if you care about these things, which is it's not so much how I hit it as where I hit it.
Oh, right.
And it tends, where in the music I hit it. And tends to be that I've displaced the beat in some funny place or way. So what happens is if something smells funny in the rhythm, they probably say that's Bill Bruford. Now, they might like that and they might hate that. And I don't care either way.
No, it's funny you say that. That is the idiosyncrasy. Because, I mean, with Nick Mason, you know, the guy and I playing with Nick currently, you know, Nick always wants to fall slightly behind the beat all the time, you know, and that's what gives it the Pink Floyd feel, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It always feels like a slower tempo than it is in the Floyd.
Exactly. It's exactly that.
It has a sort of Pink Floyd lopey sort of, you know, which never gets much more than about 99 BPM. You know, it's sort of plods, it lopes along.
Yeah. Yes.
I think
in
a rather nice way.
So you got a PhD, you went and did a PhD for 4 years at uni in music.
I did, imagine that. So I'm a musicologist now, so look out.
Well, it's because you were offered an honorary one, right? You said, but no, I want to do the graft.
I was.
You're retired.
Yeah. And they were very good to me. And I was at Surrey University. And I've got to say, you know, if at any moment you worry about or question young people who age 20 to 25, I assure you they're very smart and they play instruments really, really well. And their thinking about music is hugely exciting and encouraging. And it makes me feel like it, because I was the oldest guy on campus, of course, and I felt like a fossil. So, you know, you can imagine they're pretty smart. And music moves along at a fast pace at some of these universities. Really good.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. Well, thank you for everything you've given us, Bill, over the years. Phenomenal work.
Gary, you're very kind. I appreciate being asked on, and please edit out the embarrassing bits, won't you?
There isn't any, I don't think.
That's only from us.
Good to see you both, and thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
All the very best to you.
Cheers,
guys.
You. Bye.
Hey, that was good.
That was delightful. What a lovely man. Again, you.
And for those who obviously can't see, he's got an amazing cherubic smiling face, doesn't he, the whole time?
It does look impossibly young. There's definitely there's a portrait up in the attic, isn't there?
We'd love to get Robert Fripp on at some stage, wouldn't we? We have asked. Robert has been asked a couple of times, and he's a little bit shy, but he's also very busy doing his kitchen thing that he does with his wife Toya.
So actually, if there's anyone out there in a position to lobby Robert Fripp,
he's been very sweet about saying no. That's part of his enigma, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But he did manage to say no in 1716.
That's a musical time signature, not a year.
That would have been impressive.
Anyway, we're off. You're going to be hearing this in about a week's time, I think, or something. But because we're actually off to do our last UK gig today in real time.
Yes, at the legendary Fairfield Hall.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Very much towards that. Well, it's good night from me,
and it's good night from the 16 of us.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.